Faith is the subject of Hebrews 11. We have come to that 32nd verse of the chapter. What shall I say more? Or what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, and of Samson, who through faith subdued kingdoms. Samson didn't do that. He began to subdue the Philistines, but he did not finish the job. Samson was followed by a period of unrest, and it wasn't until Samuel came. That one isn't going to fit. Wrought righteousness. Not really. Obtained promises, yeah. Stopped the mouths of lions, yeah, he sure did that. And out of weakness were made strong. And if I were to underline any phrase in that list, it would be the last one. Out of weakness were made strong. And apply it to Samson. And as we always do, we go back to the Old Testament and look at these Old Testament characters to discover why they would make it into this list that God records in His book of those that are not, or rather the world is not worthy of them, and God's not ashamed to be called their God. The 13th chapter of Judges, then, will be the focus. So go to the Old Testament book of Judges, chapter 13, and you write it down again. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for. Literally, transubstantiates, puts solid matter in the place of what was previous hope. The source of hope is a promise of God. Hope becomes substance when God can find a father who will grab hold of the promise, and by His continuing hanging in their action, He will stay there like the conductor through which God's power can flow until what was forever settled in heaven. The moment God utters a word, that becomes fact eternally. And the faith reaches up, and through His faith, that hope becomes substance. Faith literally pragmatizes, works out to be seen what was previously not seen. It therefore is an act based upon a belief maintained in spite of anything that may shake the confidence until the hope becomes, it focuses in on the Word of God. God spoke, not a thing became everything. That gives the hope, and the faither hangs on until hope becomes fact. These men are a record of faithers. And I don't know what effect it's having on you, but it ought to shatter a lot of illusions about the kind of raw material that God can work with. Joseph, probably as pure a type of Christ as you'll find in the Bible. All of his good deeds do not gain him access to this chapter. It was that final act where he hung literally his dead bones on God's promise that gained him entrance to this chapter. Most people, when you think of Samson, immediately they link Delilah. When they think of Samson, they think of his failure. Well, Delilah was just the termination of a problem he had from day one, I guess. He had women trouble. He had a woman problem. He couldn't leave them alone. And yet, some boards of presbyters must turn purple at this. Yet, he made it into Hebrews chapter 11. Now, you that turn the dial right now and leave me there, a plague on you and all your kids. Because the next thing I hear is I'll be recommending that the way to get into God's hero ledger is have women trouble. He made it in spite of that. But let's tell the story. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. I can tell you, if any of those presbyters are listening, they won't turn me off. The children of Israel did evil again, and that's a preacher joke. That's an inside story. When I used to work as a consultant with Teen Challenge, I was the first consultant that Dave Wilkerson flew in when he discovered that he had to provide some teaching in those lives. I preached their first graduation at Rhinebeck, New York. But I was involved long before that school took shape. One of the problems we used to have in New York is it was sometimes those most judgmental-oriented kinds of presbyters and church leaders that in the name of looking at how terrible sin was, wanted to see the worst dives and spend the longest time there. I just wanted to kick them because I saw through their activities. That's the explanation, the inside joke. The children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. That's all they seemed to do. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. Again and again that word 40 crops out. It's 4, the number of the whole earth, 10, human responsibility. 40 is a full and complete testing. There was a certain man of Zorah. That's an interesting name. It means place of hornets. Of the family of the Danites, who didn't live up to their name. It means judges, whose name was Manoah. I could preach on Manoah because his name means rest. No wonder God picked him, anybody that could attain rest in a place of hornets. And his wife was barren and bare not. The angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman. Now the literal of that is the angel with a hyphen. The angel, hyphen, Jehovah. The angel Jehovah, you always know it's Jehovah when you see those capital letters, Lord, appeared unto the woman and said unto her, you're barren, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore, beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, no razor shall come on his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin, he didn't finish it, he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Then the woman came and told her husband. Now that ought to create an interesting kind of reaction. That's enough to shake Manoah's rest. She didn't know it was God talking to her. She said, a man of God. From her view, this preacher came, told me. His countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God, very terrible. I asked him not whence he was, neither told me his name. He just was there, out of the blue. And he said to me, behold, thou shalt conceive. And Manoah says, yo, and bear a son. Now drink no wine nor strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing. The Bible has to be the most interesting book in the world. Neither eat any unclean thing, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. I don't know why, I don't want to get on this issue, but I don't know why the people that are arguing on abortion don't go to this chapter. On all the arguments of when life is conceived, here's a pretty solid text from God's Word. Because the Nazarite, there are three basic elements to the vow, and it's in the sixth chapter of the book of Numbers. No wine, strong drink of any kind, fruit of the vine. Don't take any of it. No razor to touch the head at any time during the period of the Nazarite vow. Three, don't touch a dead person. If your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your wife, or your children die in violation of every tradition and custom of the day at the risk of being judged unfeeling, you don't touch that dead person in any of the customs of the day. Those were the three rules. And here, from the moment the life is conceived, the mother, knowing that the Nazarite by God's decree is to be a Nazarite from the instant that life is conceived, she must live until birth the Nazarite vow. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, "Oh my Lord," I'd have said that too if I'd have been him. When you, John, yeah, "Oh my Lord, let the man of God which thou didst send come again unto us," circle the us, "God, next time tell us both together and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born." God hearkened unto the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. I'd have stayed with her night and day. And the woman made haste and ran, good woman, and showed her husband, said unto him, "Behold, the man hath appeared unto me that came unto me the other day." And Manoah arose, ought to jump 4 feet. He arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said unto him, "Art thou the man that speakest unto the woman?" He said, "I am." Whew. Thank God. And Manoah said, "Now let thy words come to pass." The King James sure ruined this one. "How shall we order the child, and how shall we do unto him?" Sears Roebuck catalog or what? The literal is, what shall the manner of the child be, and what shall he do? A rhetorical way of speaking. You'll find the same thing said about Isaac. It's a rhetorical statement, like David when he said, "What shall be done unto the man that kills this Philistine?" The angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, "Of all that I said unto the woman, let her beware. And the Nazarite vow is lifted again. She may not eat anything that cometh of the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. All that I command her, let her observe." Now I'm going to pass it by, but there is a message to be preached about parents who want their children to be dedicated to God It starts with the parent. We willingly in this church dedicate babies. But sometimes I get the feeling the parents sort of come up and say, thank God this problem's now in God's hands. God puts it in the parents' hands. And he again says, let her beware. She may not eat of anything that cometh of the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. All that I commanded her, let her observe. Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, I pray thee, let us detain thee until we shall have made ready a kid for thee. The angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, though thou detain me, I will not eat thy bread. And if thou wilt offer a burnt offering, thou must offer it unto the Lord. For Manoah knew not that he was literally the angel, Jehovah. A lot of fact. I get so frustrated at some commentaries, I just want to throw them at the wall. I've read pages on this verse, arguing over who it was and that it couldn't have been the Lord because he was telling him to offer it to the Lord. It's the same context as when the rich young ruler came to Jesus. He said, good master, what more must I do? And Jesus says, why callest thou me good? There's none good but God. Now the humanizers of Jesus picked that one text out of context and say, see, he never really knew he was God. Never thought he was God. Hogwash. He would not let this guy come up to him as though he were just another teacher with the presumption of his pharisaical self-righteousness that goodness was a human virtue that he could attain. Don't call him good unless at the same time you recognize that if he is good, he's also God because there's none good but God. Don't offer to me while you're still viewing me as a man. Offer it unto the Lord. And when this poor rattled father-to-become gets his offering ready, then God will reveal to whom it was he was speaking. Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what's your name? That when thy sayings come to pass, we may do thee honor. The angel of the Lord said unto him, why askest thou thus after my name, seeing it secret? Same word that Isaiah uses in that powerful passage where he says, this wonderful counselor, the Almighty God, Prince of Peace, Everlasting Father. Literally what he said, why askest thou after my name, seeing it is wonderful, a wonderful secret, too much for me to cram into your head. It's just beyond your comprehension, but wonderful. So Manoah took a kid with a meat offering, offered it upon a rock unto the Lord, and the angel did wondrously. Manoah and his wife looked on. Now what did he do wondrously? Up to this point, he thinks he's just a man of God. At the most, possibly an angel. But he did wondrously. Notice the angel is put in there in italics. You notice that, don't you? Added with the translators. King James people interpreting at that point. It was okay to quote Manoah. Or his wife calling him a man. But when the inspiration description of the scene is there, it's the translators that added the word angel. Literally, Manoah took a kid with a meat offering, offered it upon a rock unto the Lord, and did wondrously. Wondrous things happened. Manoah and his wife looked on at the wondrous thing that was happening. What? For it came to pass, when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar, that the angel Jehovah ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife looked on it. They didn't look on it. That's again added by the translators. Manoah and his wife looked on and fell on their faces to the ground. But the angel Jehovah did no more appear to Manoah and to his wife. He was gone. Then Manoah knew that he, the angel, was Jehovah. And Manoah said unto his wife, "We shall surely die, because we've seen God." And this woman's smart. She concludes in a hurry, "If he wanted to kill us, why are we still standing here?" His wife said unto him, "If the Lord were pleased to kill us, he would not have received a burnt offering and a meat offering at our hands, neither would he have showed us all these things, nor would as at this time have told us such things as this." Old Manoah may be in rest in a place of hornets, but he ain't got much faith. God tells him they're going to have a son. God goes up in the flame, and there ain't no son yet, and he's instantly ready to believe he's going to get killed. No wonder God talked to that woman instead of Manoah first. "And a woman bare a son, called his name Samson." I counted today 37 pages in different commentaries arguing over the meaning of this name. Devastator, destroyer, in the light of the sun, like the sun. It comes from a root word that speaks of the life that flows out of the sun that we see. And the best translation is like the sun, Samson. "And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan." Now the camp of Dan had 600 warriors. It was about a half a day's climb up the hills from this city where he had been living. That's the city of Zorah. That city had been assigned to Judah and then was later given to Dan. It's on the western slope of those Judean hills, a little bit south of Jerusalem, and about a little bit east and south of Tel Aviv today. But up on the rise was this warrior camp. The Spirit of the Lord began to move on this lad as he was a boy, and he'd go out to that camp of Dan between Zorah, the place of hornets, and Eshtael, which is petition or the place of prayer. Then comes chapter 14 where he starts, and he's off to a good beginning. Samson went down to Timnath. Circle that word Timnath. It means portion assigned or possession or inheritance. Now let that settle in. Samson went down to Timnath and gather up every faithing saint, put them inside Samson right now. Are we not heading toward our possession? Are we not journeying toward our inheritance? Are we not moving to that place promised to us? Old John Follett used to preach on this chapter and make it a type of the Christians who head to claim their inheritance. Samson saw a woman. Now there's the seed of his problem. A woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, "I've seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me to wife." How'd you like to have a kid like that? Man alive, Jim. Kevin walks in and says, I've seen this woman. Dad, you get her for me." Then his father and his mother said unto him, "Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren or among all my people that thou goest to take a wife of this Philistines?" Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she pleaseth me well. I don't know what went on between that 25th verse and the first verse of the 14th chapter, but I have an idea that this mama and this dad spoiled this kid. He was God's choice. But I've seen it happen. You ever seen some full gospel parents when their little darling gets a little blessing? You ever seen them? You better try to whack it out of him early to make sure it's for real, or you'll set him up to become what Samson became. Isn't there somebody in our own people? Samson said, get her for me. She pleases me well. And then this strange verse, which is why I am absolutely sure that it has always been this way, even before Paul uttered it in Romans 8:28. The literal Greek says, God entereth into all things and goes toward working his good. His father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord. God knew Samson. God had called him before he was born. He was committed by his vow to the Lord. But the seed of conflict and the fight that he was going to have with his nature was there. In this case, God is going to achieve a purpose he wants in spite of Samson indeed even utilizing what was to become his Achilles heel. The Philistines had dominion over Israel, and God was going to use this to plant a cleavage in the camp. Then went Samson down, and his father and his mother to Timnath, and came to the vineyards of Timnath. Behold, a young lion roared against him. John Follett camped on this verse. He said, there's always a lion between you and your inheritance. You can count on it. As you start moving to claim an inheritance, here comes the lion. Sounds like the Apostle Peter preaching. Sounds like this whole book, doesn't it? Now I want to talk about the Nazarite vow right at this point, and then we'll go back to it. Go to number six. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. Now there are some people go through this whole book trying to correct it and make wine not wine and strong drink not strong drink. God is not saying every child in Israel, even under that law, is never to partake of this pleasurable drink. He is saying, if you want to be a Nazarite, you leave it alone. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made from the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. Twice. All the days of the vow of his separation, there shall no razor come upon his head. Bang. Up comes the Corinthian letter. The Apostle Paul says, man shouldn't have long hair, for it's a shame unto him. Now, most people don't read on. My answer to that, when they write in on the festival or call in and say, what are you going to do with this? And I know they're trying to get at my hair. And this is not a Nazarite vow. I didn't have time to go to a barber. And I had one of my staff members cut it once, and that was worse. But they need to read on. If somebody's going to be contentious, we don't have any law or custom on it. Paul is arguing, and I say, like his statements, they say, what about that Corinthian statement about women? My answer is, Paul meant for the women at Corinth to keep the mouth shut in the church. End of the subject. Want it again? Paul meant for the women at Corinth to keep the mouth shut in the church. And he meant for a man to wear long hair in Corinth was a shame. And like Paul sometimes says, on occasions, I don't know whether I'm speaking from the Lord or not. When he knew he was speaking from the Lord, he made it clear. But he says, I've said it, and it's not the norm for a man to wear it. And it becomes a shame to his manliness. But if you're going to get contentious, there is no such law or custom in the churches. But here on the other side of the coin, God lays it down. Which, by the way, ought to answer some of these debates in the modern world whether Jesus had his hair short or long. He was a Nazarite. And he wore it long. Which means he made them happy. His first miracle was to turn water into wine to keep the party going, but he didn't drink it. He was a Nazarite. No razor upon his head. First choice of the Nazarite, forego ordinary pleasures. Pleasures that will not necessarily keep you out of the family of God, keep you out of the kingdom, keep you from having eternal life. The issue is a voluntary commitment. And in Samson's case, the voluntariness of it was sort of preempted as God made him a Nazarite from birth. But the law of the Nazarite was you could take it for a number of days. It was a voluntary determination. Others can. I could, but I won't. Second dimension, it's normal for men to cut their hair. But in my case, though it makes me appear abnormal, it may even bring a view of the world that considers me wrong. I choose to make this separation. And all the days he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall come at no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean. For his father or for his mother, for his brother or for his sister, when they die. Because the consecration, or literally separation of his God, is upon his head. And all the days of his separation, he literally belongeth unto the Lord. One of the hardest things I have communicating, and some of you will remember, we preached a message on Elisha. Elisha had responded to the call of the Master when Elijah, as a type of God, cast his mantle on him. He had been plowing, doing his own thing, nothing wrong with plowing, but a claim came on his life. He turned from that way to follow his Master. He slew the oxen and burned the yoke. He separated from that life. And he went after Elijah and literally, it says, ministered unto him for 11, well, it doesn't say for 11 years, it says he ministered unto him and 11 years went by. That's pretty good Christianity. Repentance, turning from the old way to the Master, sanctification, separation from that claim. No longer was he his own to plow in that field and ministry unto his Master. But in the second chapter of the book of Kings, he was determined to have a relationship that went beyond the ordinary. God, typified in Elijah, tested his resolve. Said, stay here, stay here, stay here. There are some things you can get from God that he doesn't require from you. There are some things that he will test your resolve. The crowd, the sons of the prophets, didn't think he ought to keep going. The reason I bring it up in this context, Elisha didn't bring the subject up. He didn't say as he marched toward Jordan with his dedication, hey, the rest of you hypocrites, if you had what you ought to have from God, you'd be going with me too. We want this double portion. He didn't bring it up. And where I get angry with some people is they get a desire to commit to God, and they take about four steps toward their extreme commitment, and then they walk backwards the rest of the time, whipping every other saint because he's not making the same trip. The Nazarite vow committed you beyond the ordinary. You made a decision to forego pleasures available to others. Don't put a martyr's crown on. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Don't beat other people over the head because they don't make the same commitment. It's between the Nazarite and the Lord, period. You forego a certain normalcy that every other saint, now here comes this Nazarite. And the inevitable question is, why isn't everybody making that commitment? Because everybody is not going to be a Nazarite, period. Well, wouldn't it be good if everybody was? Sure. But if that's why they do it, it's worthless. Each person must come to that commitment relationship where his desire is to move on in God. Elisha didn't bring the subject up. It was the other quote, because it wasn't a Christian day, but I'm going to use the word Christians, the sons of the prophets, that said, why are you going on? Don't make a fanatic out of yourself. He said, hold your peace, shut your mouth. I'm going to do it. I'm not bothering you. You leave me alone. So as we preach these truths and God grips your heart and commitments are made, just make and do the commitment and let other people do the same. For some months in this church, I have said, live your convictions. Preach Christ. There's only one absolutely perfect Nazarite, Jesus. So if anybody gets a sudden call to be the greatest Christian running loose, and God knows we need one like that, just be the greatest Christian running loose, but don't preach your greatest Christian running looseness. Preach Jesus. Third, well, he wouldn't even go to his dad's funeral. Wouldn't even go to his wife's funeral. I think that's awful. He was a Nazarite. And regardless of what everybody in the camp might think, no earthly tie could dominate. What is needed in today's world is somebody to come against this message of equalization, this tendency to make every Christian homogenized, exactly the same. I've been preaching for 31 months, and I hope God gives us a host of them that will spew around the world, but only God can lay it on their heart. Give us some uncommon Christians that will say, whatever else anybody else does, this will be my commitment. That was the Nazarite. You know what the most accurate theological description of a Nazarite is? He was a living, walking altar, set apart in that way. Now, you got to have to feel sorry for poor old Samson. He didn't choose it. God laid that on him. And this is a generation that grows up in the church. And this preacher's kid that lost his faith and got it back really reaches out in his heart for those that grow up in the church, have it enculturated on them, never really come to grips until they face the reality of life themselves. And that's why I am trying so hard to get the kids in this church to understand what true commitment to Jesus really is. It's not the stamping on of the behaviors. This poor kid Samson never had a choice. He comes out either bald or long-haired, but it's no choice thereafter. Why can't I shave, Mom? Like Dad. Whack. Oh, I don't think so. No, honey, you're special. Which he was. How can I have, why can't I have some grape juice? Because you can't. You're special. Well, then go get me a woman. Everything else is denied me. Give me her. Behold, a young lion roared against him. He was en route to his inheritance. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he rent that lion as he would have rent a kid. And he had nothing in his hand, just barehanded. He told not his father or his mother what he had done. You've got to give him a plus for that. I know some people have been bragging for 40 days. But he didn't say a word about it. He went down and talked with the woman. She pleased Samson well. After a time he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see. He must have been gone a long time, because that carcass of the lion must have either dried up or left only bones. And behold, there was a swarm of bees, honey. Carcass of the lion. He just went over there and took the honey and he ate it. Gave some to his father and mother, and they did eat. He didn't tell them he'd taken the honey out of the carcass of a lion. Still not bragging. His father went down unto the woman. They made a feast. I got to hurry along. And it was a custom in that day to, you know, make riddles. So Samson says, I'll put you forth a riddle. If you can declare it to me within the 7 days of the feast, and they're having a big wedding feast now, and find out what this riddle is, I'll give you 30 sheets, or shirts, literally, and 30 changes of garments. Now, here he is betting. Now, that's typical. You know, the Pharisees, when Jesus came on the scene, they started out all right. They led the Maccabean Rebellion. The name Pharisee literally means separatist. And God's faith is so degenerated, they turned the temple into a gymnasium. They started out restoring to God's people right actions and relationship to God. But by the time Jesus came along, it was all rules. Nothing left in the way of life. Samson hadn't gotten to that place yet. But that's what the religion of legalism does for you. You could walk 3/5 of a mile on a Sabbath. So if they wanted to go further than that, you could walk that 3/5 from your possessions. So the smart guys would go the day before the Sabbath and throw down a handkerchief, 3/5 of a mile, go another 3/5 of a mile, throw down a shirt, another 3/5 of a mile, throw down a sock, whatever they own. And then they're 3/5 of a mile from the fishing hole by four legs. So on the Sabbath, they can go to their handkerchief, their shirt, and their sock, and 3/5 of a mile to the fishing hole, and they've technically kept the rule. They've only walked 3/5 of a mile from their possession. Man always figure out a way. But old Samson, he's betting. He's gambling. What are you doing? If you can figure my riddle out, I'll give it to you. And if you can't figure it out, you don't get it. Here's the riddle. Out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. Sheer nonsense in the King James. The literal is, food came from the devourer, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. Meat, for example, they had the meat offering in that day. It was literally the meal offering. It was the staff of life. Meat was a generic phrase for food. Out of the eater or the devourer came food, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. They couldn't expound the riddle. So they came to his wife, said, "Entice thy husband, so he'll tell us the riddle, lest we burn thee and your father's house with fire. Have you called us that he can take what we got? We got to figure this out. We'll burn you and your dad and your house if you don't get it from him." She wept before him. "Thou dost but hate me and lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle unto the children of my people and hasn't told it to me." Bless her heart. "You haven't told it to me, sweetie." And he said unto her, "Behold, I haven't told it to my dad or my mother, and I've had them longer than I had you. Shut up, woman. Shall I tell it to thee?" And there's a never-failing weapon. She wept before him. The 7 days, just squalling while the feast lasted. No joy. Now, isn't that a honeymoon feast for you? Oh, for 7 days. Came to pass on the 7th day, he told her. Now, start figuring out a pattern with this guy. And I want you to learn something about what God's dealing with in our nature. Abram had a problem. He was a liar under pressure. And every time he's got off the track, he would lie. And the sin of the father came out in the son. Isaac had that problem. If you've ever been defeated by God at any point, you better draw a circle around that item and kick it every morning, because it'll come out again if you don't kill that weakness in your nature. Right here at the outset, the only woman that God actually approved. Now, if he had been the kind of Nazarite he ought to have been, he'd have said when this one was over, "God, I'll snatch my hair out by the roots and wear blinders the rest of my days before I'll ever look at another woman." When he saw the ability of this woman to persuade him against his own judgment. God's book is very honest. Now, I don't know what your problem may be, but whatever it is, recognize that from the seed, the tree grows. When you recognize the problem, if you want a little problem to become a big problem, let it grow a while. Nail it to the wall. She lay sore upon him, like a running sore, squalling, You haven't told me. Well, it came to pass, he told her, because she lay sore upon him, and she told the riddle to the children of her people. And the men of the city said unto him, on the seventh day before the sun went down, the time is not yet past, but they already know the answer. So before the day even finishes, they come to him and let him know with a little smart remark, they know what the riddle is. What is sweeter than honey? It's like, ha-ha, we figured your riddle out. I'll give you a hint, let you know that I know it. And when the sun goes down, I'm going to tell you your riddle. What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? And old Samson came forth with one of the most graphic statements ever in print. If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have found out my riddle. And he should have said, by God's grace, if I ever meet another heifer, I'm going the other direction. Because he couldn't handle his heifer. The Spirit of the Lord came on him. He went down to Ashkelon. I mean, he left the little heifer alone. He went down to Ashkelon. Took it out on those poor guys. Slew 30 of them. Took their garments. Came back and paid the debt with it. His anger was kindled. He went up to his father's house and left his heifer. Off he went. Well, that didn't bother his father-in-law. His father-in-law gave his wife to the best man at Samson's funeral. It was his funeral. Freudian slip. But it came to pass. It was the best man of Samson's wedding that got Samson's wife now. Came to pass within a while after, not much time. Old Samson, he was away from the heifer a while, and now he wanted the heifer back. In the time of the wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a kid. Now that's a lamb, a goat kid. And he said, I will go into my wife, into the chamber. Her father says, no, you won't. I thought you had utterly hated her, so I gave her to your best friend. Now look at her sister. Her sister's younger and fairer than she is. Take her, I pray thee, instead of your other wife. Samson said, now shall I be more blameless than the Philistines if I do them a displeasure? Now here he is reacting to his heifer. He went and caught 300 foxes. The word in the Hebrew is to catch him with a net. Now can't you see this old Samson? He's so mad. He's out there netting. Jackals is the word, not foxes. He's out catching jackals. And he's thinking it up. And he ties their tails together. And he puts them in the cornfields that in that day ran for miles. And he puts a torch between the tails of two of them. When I was a kid once, I hate to say it, but I witnessed somebody putting turpentine on a dog. It's awful. And it shouldn't have been done to the dog, that is. But to these jackals, he tied their tails together. Now, can't you see him thinking this up? 300. That was a 150 torches charging through the cornfield. Follow Samson saying, that'll teach you to take my heifer. And the standing corn burn up the shocks and the corn and the vineyards and the olives. Burn everything. When the Philistine said, who had done this? They answered, Samson, the son-in-law of that Timnite that gave his wife away, gave her to his best friend. Philistines came up and burnt her and her father with fire. You know, God's got his own poetic justice. You remember what her friends said they were going to do to her? If she didn't wheedle out of Samson the riddle, she got it anyway. Samson said unto him, though ye have done this, yet will I be avenged of you. And after that, I'll stop. He had sent the foxes, or the jackals. Now he smote them, hip and thigh, with a great slaughter. Just killing them right and left. Went down and dwelt on the top of the rock, Etam. Etam means a place of ravenous creatures. The Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi, which means jawbone. And the men of Judah said, why are ye come up against us? And they answered, to bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he had done to us. And then those miserable, scaredy cat, marshmallow Judeans, that kingly tribe from which Jesus was to come forth, that had been given that inheritance of that area, but had let the Philistines take it. Now that cowardly bunch, 3,000 of them, turned on Samson. For whatever reasons, he was knocking the tar out of the Philistines. And here come the Judeans. Why are you come against us? They said to the Philistines, to bind up Samson. So, to keep the heat off of themselves, these 3,000 men of Judah, Gideon routed the enemy with 300. There's 3,000 shameful, gutless men of Judah. They went up to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, knowest thou not that the Philistines are the attorney general over us? What is this that thou hast done unto us? He's going to get after us for what you're doing. He said unto them, as they did unto me, so have I done unto them. And these men of Judea said, we're come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistines. Samson said, he's crafty. He said, swear unto me that you won't fall on me yourselves. Okay? We won't. And they bound him up with two new cords and brought him up from the rock. So here he comes. And when he came to Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the cords broke as though they were flax. And he found a new jawbone of an ass, put forth his hand, took it, and slew 1,000 men therewith. The Hebrew's funny. Ass and heaps are the same word. What it really said is, with the jawbone of an ass, asses on top of asses, I've killed 1,000 of them. He just beat their head in with that jawbone of an ass. It came to pass, when he'd made an end of speaking, put flesh and blood on this guy. There is, literally, when it says new jawbone, it means moist jawbone. It hadn't yet dried. And he just picks up this jawbone out of the skeleton of that ass, and he then takes it. And see him wading into the Philistines and killing 1,000 of them as he clubs them to death. And when he got done, as is so often the case, immediately when you win a victory, look out. He was sore athirst, called on the Lord and said, thou hast given this great deliverance into the hand of thy servant. And now, shall I die for thirst and fall into the hands of the enemy? Am I going to kill 1,000 of them and win this great victory, and then in the exhaustion have to beg these enemy for a drink to keep from dying of thirst. God clave a hollow place that was in the jaw. Theologians will argue from now till Jesus comes whether it's spouted out of the jawbone itself or out of a hollow in the ground, because the place was called Lehi also, which means jawbone. God clave a hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout, and when he had drunk, his spirit came again, which in the Hebrew, he was near death. And he revived, whereupon, or wherefore he called the name of it, in Hakkori, which is in Lehi unto this day, and he judged the Philistines in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Too bad the story couldn't end right there. Too bad that you can't skip the 16th chapter, except for that which we will learn in these closing minutes about the grace of God. None of this is the reason he's in Hebrews 11. He didn't have any choice. God ordained him to be a Nazarite. He proved himself unworthy of that calling, but I still can understand the fleshly reactions as he grew up in this frame. And you see him using his power. God is letting it defeat the Philistines, but unlike some of the other judges who came and defeated the enemy and then ruled with peace, Samson began to break their bondage, but he proved himself unworthy of the vow of the Nazarene itself. Watch him. Then went Samson to Gaza, and there he saw a woman, a prostitute, and he went into her. Here he is again. Same problem. When you've got a problem, if you were ever a kleptomaniac and you were only 9 years old, whip your hands every day till you get it over with. Battle whatever that problem is. On matters of sin, I have the same message I have on matters of prayer. Don't pray when you're praying, as you've heard me say 100 times. Oh, Father, in heaven, on your throne, with cherubims flying around, singing holy, 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 with smoke before thee and the post of the door shaking, creator of the universe, eternal, omnipotent, forever King. Just say, oh, my Father, it's my little toe on my left foot. It hurts. Heal that one. Get to the point. If you got a sin that is your besetting sin, just leave the big mass of problems alone and tackle that one until you get it under control, because the wiles of the devil are such, he knows what your weak point is, and you better believe that's the one where he will always have temptation available. Kill it at the root. Samson's got woman problems. He saw this prostitute. He didn't go there to see her. We're not even given the benefit of knowing why he went to Gaza. But after he got there, one look was enough. He was told, the Gazites, Samson is in town. Let's get him. They were quiet all night, saying in the morning, we're going to kill him. They never expected him to leave. But about midnight, Samson rose, and he took the doors of the gate of the city, show off, and the two posts, went away with them, bar and all, put the whole works on his shoulders, and carried it off up the top of a hill that is before Hebron, 11 miles by the calculation, as best I can find, of where that city is and the hill he went to. 11 miles, he carries the whole gate, the bar and everything. Show off, and you begin to see A certain seed start to come out in his life. Came to pass afterward, he loved a woman. Here it is again. Delilah is the name this time. Literally, Delilah means the weak or languishing one. He loved her. The lords of the Philistines came up unto her and said unto her, entice him. See where his great strength lieth. We want to get him and bind him. So she starts to prevail on him. They offer her the equivalent. I've never seen it figured out in dollars, but I've seen it figured out 600 pounds English sterling. And Delilah started working on him. Tell me, I pray thee, wherein is thy great strength, and wherewith thou mightest be bound to afflict thee? And like a moth to a flame, he can't get his head on. He ought to flash back, as Abram should have flashed back to his lie in Egypt. But sin has that quality to so darken the mind that when we look at it in perspective, we can't fathom how it would happen, but it happens. Kill it when it rears its head. Here's the same scene. A woman who's going to use her influence. And he plays the game, the vain show-off. That other seed in him that made him carry the gates off comes out. He plays the game. Bind me with green whiz. Now that's cords like you make the bow of an arrow. It could be catgut to any form of the sinew of the leg of a cow or an animal. Very strong. Bind me with that, he says. And they should be those that have not yet dried. She did it. Now, there were men lying in wait, abiding with her in the chamber, but don't you ever believe they showed their head yet. She tested it first. She said, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. He just broke those with as though they were paper. I would have said, my Lord, here's another heifer. Get me out of here. But old dumb Samson kept entertaining that which would destroy him. Now remember this. The people haven't charged out of the room yet. To Samson, it's still a game. Delilah said unto Samson, you would be amazed at how many people that I know about that would have found it much easier to say no the first time. But as you start playing the game, Delilah said to Samson, you've mocked me now. You've told me lies. I've seen that kind of treatment too. He's worse than she is in his dumb mind as she casts her spell on him. I pray thee, tell me what I can bind you with. He said, well, if you'll bind me with new ropes, and he's getting closer to his vow. New ropes have never been used, which is analogous to the Nazarite separation. They were never occupied. Then I'll be as weak as another man. She took the ropes and bound him and said unto him, the Philistines be upon thee. Now can't you see this muscled up Hercules and his languishing beautiful Delilah playing this silly game in her bedroom? Tying him up and splat, he's breaking them. Delilah said, the Philistines are on you. I can see this goony bird Samson staring into her droopy eyes, showing off. There were liars in wait abiding in the chamber, but he'd break those new cords like a thread. Still, the guys haven't come out of the chamber yet. Delilah said to Samson, hitherto thou hast mocked me. You're lying to me. Tell me. Come on, tell me.
He said unto her, well, if you weave the 7 locks of my head with a web, and she had a standing weaving thing, had a web already in it, so she's going to weave his hair into that web. And she even goes further. She catches him asleep, and she weaves his hair into that web that's already there on the weaver's beam, and then she drives a peg down to hold it there. She fastened it with a pin, said unto him, it was a tent peg, really, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. Now he's sleeping. Already comes like an alarm clock, the word Philistine. And he ripped up the weaver's beam, the pin, everything. Boom. She said, "How can't you hear it now? How canst thou say I love thee when thine heart is not with me? Thou hast mocked me these 3 times, and you've not told me wherein thy great strength lies. How could a man be so dumb?" You men shaking your head are giving yourself away. His problem was women. What's yours? The pattern is what I'm interested in teaching. Get away from it. If it's conquered you once, get away from it. Like an alcoholic proving to himself he won't take a drink by putting a bottle on the table. Break every bottle in the house. How can you say, I love thee? I don't know how to say it like she must have said it. It came to pass when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him, so that his soul was vexed unto death. What that other woman do to him? Because she lay sore upon him, he finally told her. Now she vexed him unto death. So he told her all his heart and said unto her, there hath not come a razor upon my head. I've been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will go, and I'll be weak like any other man. When Delilah, and they know, when Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up this once, for he showed me all his heart. They came up, brought money in their hand. Smart old gal, she's going to get paid first. And she made him sleep upon her knees. She called for a man. He's snoring away. Samson, that is. She caused him, the man that came, to shave off the 7 locks of his head. And she began to afflict him, and his strength went from him. She said, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. He woke up out of sleep, and he had played the game so long, the dummy didn't even shake his head and realize it was gone. He said, I'll go out as other times before and shake myself. And he wished not that the Lord had departed from him. But the Philistines took him, put out his eyes, the literal is, bored out his eyes, and brought him down to Gaza, and bound him with fetters of brass, feet and hands, and he did grind in the prison house. And the literal is, grind corn in the prison house. Howbeit the hair of his head began to grow again, after he was shaven. God had not forgotten him, even though he was in that prison house. The lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice unto Dagon, their god. Dagon was the fish god. And those Philistines figured that God, the people of Judah and Israel, had the god of the mountains and they had the god of the sea. But as they had conquered Samson, now Dagon was moving on dry land. They're going to have a party. That our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hand. When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, our God, Dagon, hath delivered into our hands our enemy, and the destroyer of our country, which slew many of us. It came to pass when their hearts were merry, they said, bring out Samson, that he may make a sport. The literal is, that he may dance to our music. And they called for Samson out of the prison house, and he made them He danced before them. And they set him between the pillars. There were 3,000 people on the roof, and all the lords of the Philistines and those that were inside the court merrymaking. Samson now. And I come to the whole purpose of this message. Why? He is in. And don't bother to count me down. I know right where I'm at. Why he's in Hebrews 11. None of this other got him there. He did not choose to be a Nazarite. That choice was laid on him by God. That's prevenient grace. He hadn't yet responded fully. He had been used, the Spirit of the Lord had come on him, but the problems of his life dominated him instead of God dominating him. Now, blinded, enslaved, grinding corn in a prison house, dancing to the music under coercive force of the Philistines. Samson said unto the lad that held him by the hand, suffer me, that I may feel the pillars whereupon the house standeth, that I may lean upon them. Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. And on the roof, 3,000 men and women that beheld while Samson had danced to their music. Samson called unto the Lord, the word of Jehovah, and said, O Lord God, literally in the original, O my Lord. And notice it's small Lord in the King James. Now he is using Adonai. Remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God. And Elohim is the word in that case. Every name for God is in that prayer. Behind his blinded eyes, grinding in the prison house. Finally, the Nazarite from birth becomes the Nazarite in fact. And he, in this last act, is going to come from a coercive assignment to an expression of faith. The first one, really, is like what we've seen of Joseph and Jacob. In the extremity, he is suddenly driven to God and to an understanding of his relationship. And literally he said, Samson called unto Jehovah and said, Oh my God. He still is hanging on to God in spite of it. I pray thee, strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God Elohim, that I may be at once avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. Samson took hold of the two middle pillars upon which the house stood, and on which it was borne up, of the one with his right hand, the other with his left. Samson said, Let me die with the Philistines. And he bowed himself with all his might. The house fell upon the lords and upon the people that were therein. So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew with his life. And in that last act of faith, out of weakness, he was made strong. And for the first time, Samson had to do what we ordinary Christians have to do. He had to take a step of faith. He was born as a boy, it said. The Spirit of the Lord would come on him, he'd go out to Dan. He had to lose what he had to get in that position where his final act was suddenly to act in faith, which was to hang his body on God's promise that when you turn to him, he'll turn to you. And in the last moment, his faith act was to bend those arms around those pillars or push those pillars, whichever way he did it. And down it came. Now, you got to read the Nazarite vow to understand what happens. In the days of the vow, you read in number 6, any time that any man has failed in his vow, he is to come, and it starts about the 7th verse. That's still in the vow. He's not to touch anything dead. He'll not make himself unclean for his father, his mother, or his brother, because the consecration of God is upon his head. All the days of his separation, he's holy unto the Lord. But if any man die very suddenly by him, let's say he's standing, the guy drops dead, and as he falls, he touches him, he is defiled. If any man die suddenly by him and touch him, he hath defiled the head of his consecration. He shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing. On the 7th day shall he shave it. And on the 8th day he shall bring 2 turtles or 2 young pigeons to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Just the simple touch of that dead man makes him have to offer a sin offering for the condition of sin, another for a burnt offering, which was the act of dedication to God that is typifying what happens at Calvary. It's the atonement as it looks toward God. And he shall consecrate unto the Lord the days of his separation, and shall bring a lamb of the first year for a trespass offering. The sin offering was the act of expiation manward. It was the substitute becoming the object of God's wrath. The burnt offering was the act of total dedication, typifying Jesus dying willingly for our sins. The trespass offering took care of the specific sins, whereas the sin offering took care of the condition of sinfulness. The trespass offering blotted out the specific sin. For just the touch of a man dropping dead accidentally by him, the whole type of Calvary was necessary to cleanse him. He shall bring the lamb of the first year for a trespass offering, but the days that were before shall be lost because his separation was defiled. He may have been a Nazarene for 40 years, and a guy accidentally dropped dead and falling touched him. He had to go through the whole sacrifice that typified the entire act of Christ at Calvary, and the 40 years was wiped out as though he had never done it. He started over at zero. He didn't make it in because he was a good Nazarite. He failed as a Nazarite. His failure as a Nazarite is the graphic story of Samson. God's wishes, God's will, God's desire, and the dedication of all those years was wiped out. When Delilah cut those locks, it was as though he had never grown a hair on his head. What got him in the 11th chapter? It's a message the New Testament keeps saying over and over again. That Old Testament law was a schoolmaster to teach us that we can't measure up to that standard in our strength. As Abram made it in by faith, Samson made it in. The Nazarite vows wiped out, but his last act was an act of casting himself by faith onto God. And God put him in the book. What's that got to do with you and me tonight? We can consecrate, as I said, but the Nazarite vow was wiped out as the law was wiped out in the fulfillment of the vow, in that Jesus perfectly and completely kept that Nazarite vow. And if I had time, I'd go through the rest of this 6th chapter tonight and show you that when the Nazarite vow has been kept completely, there is the opportunity to be done with it. The Nazarite is finished with his vow. He comes into the priest he brings his offerings, and added to all the other offerings is the peace offering, and he even cuts off the beard and cuts off the hair and burns it underneath the peace offering, as all the saints rejoice with him for the accomplishment of the Nazarite vow. That burning of the hair has been accomplished. The one true Nazarite did it all, and ours is a peace offering relationship tonight. And whereas Samson could reach through his blind eyes and have faith in God for one act, we're asked tonight to believe that the same God who remembered, blinded Samson in spite of his failures, and would honor him and say the world was not worthy of him, and that God was not ashamed to be called his God, because his last act of faith deserved entry into that hall. This 11th chapter is saying that's what God's still looking for. And in our struggles and in our stress, thank God, we don't have to be a Nazarite to get delivered. I don't mind if you're a Nazarene, but you don't have to be a Nazarite to get delivered. You just have to have faith in the Nazarene who's already offered, the Nazarite who's already offered the peace offering, and says, "Come unto me." And the faith that Samson had is what we can express tonight to our deliverance.